Okay, so I'm going to be talking today about, get this out of the way, generating initial data for interacting compact binaries. And of course, this is an interesting topic for us because for any evolutions that we do, the data that you get out is only going to be as good as the data that goes in the beginning of the calculation. What I'm going to do in this talk is I'm going to start out by looking at the general formalisms that go into generating initial data, sort of look at the most recent perspectives on this, and then back up and review some of what's been done in recent years with regard to compact binary initial data. And then end up talking about some recent work that I've done in collaboration with Harold Pfeiffer in constructing binary black hole initial data. So that'll sort of be the end of the talk, and that's going to be showing some new results that really haven't been shown, well, they've been shown only one other place so far. So I'm going to be concentrating entirely on Cauchy initial data, so there won't be any characteristic initial data, sorry. And so naturally, I'll be dealing with the 3 plus 1 decomposition of space-time. And so I'm going to start out with a slide just to get everybody on the same page, with familiar with my notation. So we're going to decompose the space-time metric. We're going to have the usual lapse and shift. And the dynamical variables that we're interested in are, of course, the spatial metric and the extrinsic curvature. The spatial metric, of course, is just the induced metric on the spatial hypersurface induced from the full 4 metric. And the extrinsic curvature is defined in the usual way. And of course, given the 3 plus 1 decomposition, Einstein's equations break down into a set of 12 evolution equations, one each for each of the dynamical variables up here, and a set of 4 constraint equations. And these constraints are, of course, have to be satisfied on each spatial hypersurface. And in general, what you're interested in doing in constructing initial data is finding a way of choosing these 12 quantities up here, the metric and extrinsic curvature, in some way which is consistent with the constraint equations. But of course, there are 4 constraint equations. There are 12 degrees of freedom in these initial data variables up here. And so, in general, there's no unique way of doing this. There's no unique way of deciding which things you're going to let be freely specifiable, which things are going to be constrained. So you have to make some choices here. You have to choose a decomposition. And again, it's just not unique, but the most there are several common decompositions that are in common use. And nicely enough, recently Jimmy York and Harold Pfeiffer have published a paper with a decomposition which actually sort of unifies all of this. And so I'm going to call this the generalized conformal transverse chaseless decomposition. And it takes this form. So if you want to take your metric and you want to start breaking it into pieces that you can find that are constrained and those which are going to be freely specifiable, well, you start out with the spatial metric, and we're going to do a conformal transformation on this. So we have a conformal factor sitting here, and we now have a conformal 3 metric. So this is the decomposition we'll use for the spatial metric. For the extrinsic curvature, we're going to break it into a trace piece, and what's left over is a symmetric trace-free tensor, which we're then going to conformally transform. So we have another quantity here, A tilde, which is your conformal trace-free extrinsic curvature, and that's going to be further decomposed. Okay, your conformal trace-free extrinsic curvature, we're going to break into a piece which looks like this. This is an operator. It's the conformal killing operator acting on a vector. Okay, so we got a vector sitting here, and this constructs a symmetric trace-free tensor out of it. And I'll come back to what sigma is. In the normal view of these decompositions, this quantity M is going to be a transverse traceless tensor. But in general, if you're going to be building initial data, you don't have a priori a transverse traceless tensor. You need to take a symmetric trace-free tensor and subtract off the longitudinal part. Basically, you just decompose this in the same way you're decomposing A by subtracting off a longitudinal piece. So what I've written up here is a more general approach useful in constructing initial data, where M is just going to be a symmetric trace-free tensor, and the process of getting rid of the longitudinal parts of this is absorbed into this vector V. Okay, so this is just going to be a symmetric trace-free tensor. And finally, in this decomposition, we have a weight. And this weight is what's really new in this sort of new view of the initial data problem. This is a weighting which defines the kind of transverse traceless decomposition you're going to be using. And so now what we have is really a whole family of decompositions, parameterized by the choice of this weighting function here. Now, to put a little perspective on this, the traditional approaches that have been used in the past for constructing initial data have, for example, used this quantity sigma tilde equal to 1. That's the most common choice that's been made in the past, or the most frequently used decomposition has been the choice where sigma tilde is 1. And this has been called by some people the conformal transverse traceless method, or by Jim Eisenberg, method A. Okay. You can also choose sigma tilde, or rather sigma, to be 1. Sigma and sigma tilde are conformally related. If you choose sigma equal to 1, you get what's called the physical transverse traceless method, or method B. That was actually the first of these general methods that was derived, but the other methods seem to be a little bit more useful. So this other choice gives you the other common decomposition. There's a caveat in there. You also have to do an extra conformal rescaling of the conformal extrinsic curvature, but that's a detail. Morally, this is really the same method. So these traditional methods fall into this generalized conformal transverse traceless decomposition. And also, the method which has been most used recently, the conformal thin sandwich decomposition, also falls within this general class. If you make the definitions that sigma tilde is going to be twice the conformal lapse, and you let this tensor M be given in terms of another quantity called U tilde, which this U tilde is usually, or is, just related to the time rate of change of the conformal 3 geometry. And so the conformal thin sandwich, again, it's a subclass of this, but it's useful to think of it by itself, because there's also a change in perspective that you get when you go to the conformal thin sandwich above and beyond simply choosing making these choices for these quantities. So to understand that change in perspective, let me step back for a second and look at the generalized conformal decomposition up here and think about what are the quantities which are freely specifiable and which ones are constrained. Well, the freely specifiable quantities are going to be your conformal 3 geometry, the quantities in red up here, the trace of K, this tensor M, okay, and your choice of the conformal, or the choice of the weighting of your transverse traceless decomposition. Those are the freely specifiable quantities in general. But when you go to this conformal thin sandwich decomposition, you change your perspective a little bit, and it's a useful change. You still have these two quantities being freely specified, and in essence, you have this quantity being freely specified too. It's still M, but now you think of this as being the time rate of change at the conformal 3 geometry. So we have the time rate, so we have the conformal 3 geometry, and its time rate of change being freely specified. And we have the trace of K being specified freely, but instead of having sigma, or in this case, the conformal lapse being specified freely, we're going to, you know, look at this, we're going to try and make this more symmetric. So we have the quantity and its time rate of change. So we're going to take the trace of K and its time rate of change as a freely specified quantity. And now if you look at what the time rate of change of K is, you look at the evolution equation that gives you that, that becomes an elliptic equation for the lapse. So in essence, instead of directly specifying the lapse, you're going to specify it indirectly through the time rate of change of K. So there's a nice symmetry here in this conformal thin sandwich decomposition in this perspective. Okay, so part of the goal in choosing this particular decomposition is that the constraint equations that I showed you on the previous page take the form of nice elliptic equations in terms of these decompositions. So we have the Hamiltonian constraint equation up here, takes this nice quasi-linear elliptic form, and we have the momentum constraint equation, takes this nice elliptic form, and these are a coupled set of equations. And in the case of the conformal thin sandwich decomposition, we add one more equation to the Hamiltonian momentum constraints. We have this equation for what you might call the constant trace K equation. Okay, so we have now a set of 5 coupled equations as opposed to a set of 4 coupled equations. All right, and one more time, let's look a little bit at the degrees of freedom contained in this decomposition. So we have our kinematical variables, the lapse and the shift, and the initial data variables. As I said before, there are 12 degrees of freedom split between the metric and extrinsic curvature. And in terms of, if we look at the metric, again, it has the conformal factor and the conformal metric. The conformal factor has one degree of freedom, and it's the constrained degree of freedom. The 5 degrees of freedom left in the conformal metric are split as 3 spatial degrees of freedom. That's your initial gauge choice, your initial spatial gauge choice, and 2 dynamical degrees of freedom. And these are all freely specifiable when you're choosing initial data. The extrinsic curvature, well, we have this vector V has 3 degrees of freedom, and these are the constrained degrees of freedom. This operator I mentioned before, which is the conformal killing operator, takes just this form, so you can see it written out. This tensor, symmetric trace-free tensor M, really has 2 degrees of freedom, because remember, we're going to remove 3 of its degrees of freedom through a transverse traceless decomposition. So basically, we're going to do the same decomposition. You basically solve this equation for vector X and subtract the longitudinal part off of this, and we do this in actuality by combining X here with the V that we're going to solve in the momentum constraint. So really, there are just 2 degrees of freedom sitting in here. We have the temporal gauge degree of freedom being associated with the trace of the extrinsic curvature. And finally, you have basically the definition of the TT decomposition you're going to use as being, something which you're free to specify. So all of these are freely specifiable degrees of freedom in your approach for constructing initial data. So that's sort of a general overview of how you go about constructing initial data. And it's one way of doing it, and it's not unique. But it seems to be the most useful way of doing it for general situations. The only cases that I know that have been tried are the 3 that I've shown here. There's a whole range of possibilities. The question becomes, what's the motivation for these other choices? And in fact, the motivation for choices A and B were convenience. And what we're doing now is finding physical motivations for choices of these. Okay, so now let me back up and start looking at a little bit of history for initial data for binary compact binaries. And let's start by looking at black hole initial data. And in the traditional approach for doing this, an approach which has been used for over 20 years now, close to 25 years, I guess, the following choices were made. You take the conformal 3 geometry to be flat. You set M to be 0. Okay? You use maximal slicing, so trace of K is 0. And we're going to use method A, so sigma tilde is 1. When you make all of those choices, something really nice happens for you. The momentum constraint completely decouples from the Hamiltonian constraint. It reduces to this particular form right here. And you can find analytic solutions for this equation that represent a black hole with linear momentum and spin. And these are the Bowen and York solutions. And so this allows us a way to construct analytically this conformal trace-free extrinsic curvature. Okay? And because this is a linear equation, we can add solutions for single black holes together and construct an extrinsic curvature that represents multiple black holes, each with individually specifiable linear momentum and spin. So this seems to be a really nice approach for doing things. You now have left for you the task of solving the Hamiltonian constraint, which is just this simple quasi-linear elliptic equation. And once again, there are multiple ways of approaching this. And there are, in general, 3 schemes which have been used. One of them is called the conformal imaging approach, which is sort of the generalization, the time asymmetric generalization of what's called Misner data. And what you have here is 2 asymptotically flat hypersurfaces connected by a number of throats, 1 each for each black hole. And what makes this approach unique is that the data on the 2 hypersurfaces here are taken to be isometric. They're equivalent in a particular way. And this isometry allows you to know how the field in one sheet is going to behave if you know it in the other. And in particular, there's a fixed point set of the isometry which occurs at the throats where these surfaces join. And this allows you to construct boundary conditions on any piece of data that you want. So this is a very useful thing. So in principle, what you do when you want to construct initial data, you don't worry about the second sheet. You just take yourself a copy of R3, cut a couple of holes out of it, specify boundary conditions on those holes based on the boundary conditions you get from this fixed point set in the isometry, and you solve it. Another approach is sort of the generalization of Brill-Lindquist data, where now each of your black holes up in this one asymptotically flat sheet is connected to its own asymptotically flat sheet. So there's no isometry condition anymore. These are all individual, reach individual asymptotic infinities. And this approach is actually very computationally convenient to use because you can factor out the singular behavior of the conformal factor as you approach infinity here. And this is called the puncture method, which you've heard mentioned quite a few times in previous lectures. And what's nice about this is you really don't have to worry about boundary conditions. Your boundary conditions are essentially built in to the singular decomposition that you use. You factor it out analytically. And then you just have to solve for regular functions over R3. So that's a nice method for doing for calculating initial data based on these Bowen-York extrinsic curvatures. And there's one other approach that you can use, which basically ignores the topology of the initial data hypersurface completely. It simply says you're going to have some apparent horizon in here associated with each black hole, and you use a boundary condition on the conformal factor which guarantees that that your inner boundary, whatever the hole is you cut out in your copy of R3 is, you demand that be an apparent horizon. Okay? And so that gives you a way of constructing a black hole spacetime without worrying about what the topology is. So all of these methods allow you to construct very general configurations of multiple black holes. Again, each one can have individually specifiable linear momentum and spin. So it seems like a wonderful way of constructing initial data, but there are limitations to it. It's fundamentally limited by the fact that, one, you've chosen conformally flat, but more importantly, you are using this particular construction for the extrinsic curvature. And in the end, these happen not to be the choices you want to make for astrophysical binaries. But, what do I want to say here? So let's just look at what's been done, the early work that's been done with these black hole and neutron star initial data sets. So keeping still with the black hole binaries, with this traditional data, what you have to understand, and I want to emphasize, is that this data was constructed based on computational convenience. Okay, the choice of conformally flatness and maximal slicing were chosen to make the problem simple and not on any strong physical arguments. And with this data, the research focused on, for example, methods of solving the Hamiltonian constraint for one or more black holes, understanding the physical content of this, and in particular, the limitations of it. So starting to understand just how good or how bad is this initial data. And also, in the process of doing that, looking through the parameter space and finding those solutions which would represent two black holes as nearly as possible in circular orbits. And so this is the sort of approach which was used to find the innermost stable circular orbit for the data sets which John Baker talked about yesterday, evolving the black holes. So this was all work that was done quite a while ago. And more recently, sort of a bit of a generalization of this was to consider boosted Kerr as sort of a basis for building your initial data. And this was an interesting idea. You know, it allowed one to get past the idea of conformal flatness and using the Bowen-York extrinsic curvature, and also forced everybody to start solving coupled sets of equations because you had to solve all four equations. The idea was, of course, you take the Kerr solution and you boost it, and that gives you a metric and an extrinsic curvature, and you, through a careful construction, put two of them together, so you get basically a conformal 3 geometry and an M tensor, basically you can think of it as a background extrinsic curvature. that you then correct through this initial data procedure. And so you can use boosted cur to construct binary black hole initial data sets. And you know, this approach, it works, but it lacks well-motivated boundary conditions when you're solving constraint equations. That's one problem. And in the end, as I'll say a little bit more later, it really turns out to be not that much of an advantage over the traditional approach of conformal flatness and the Bowen-York extrinsic curvature. So I've talked an awful lot about black holes so far. I haven't said anything about neutron stars. The earliest work with neutron stars, of course, was work for single neutron stars. These would be stationary, rotating neutron stars. This sort of initial data, if you want to think of it as initial data, actually, since it's stationary, it's a full space-time, but you can also think of it as being initial data. These were constructed with a different approach. But let's see, what do I want to say about this? But this was the early work with neutron stars, and research here focused on the various numerical methods and on ways of finding both rigidly rotating and differentially rotating systems. And a lot of the work done here was actually studying parameter space for these rotating systems with various different polytropic and realistic equations of state. So a lot of work went into you know, studying this and the properties of neutron stars in isolation. So what about more recent things? So let's come a little bit closer to the present here. The data schemes that I just discussed, well, as I said, they don't represent with sufficient fidelity the details of the processes or the configurations that we're most interested in. And what we're really interested in are astrophysical compact binaries, which are inspiraling. Okay? And in the case of the black holes, you know, the choices that were made of conformal flatness and the Bowen and York extrinsic curvatures limit this, our choices, and they don't really represent these astrophysical compact binaries. And we saw that when we started looking at this data in various forms. First of all, the conformal flatness assumption doesn't represent rapidly spinning black holes, either individually or in, or if you have multiple holes. They don't represent that very well. But that's not, you know, a huge concern, although we certainly want to get things right. It also contains sort of an unphysical transverse traceless part to it, which doesn't accurately represent orbiting binaries. And that contribution is really coming largely from the Bowen and York analytic extrinsic curvature. It doesn't model the physics of a binary very well if you simply put in two boosted black holes. The residual transverse traceless parts are not really what you want. And the same thing happens if you try and use this boosted Kerr extrinsic curvature and this Kerr approach for constructing initial data. You're again trying to take two boosted black holes to represent something which is in a sort of this binary system, and what's, you know, these residual fields just don't represent the astrophysics well. So it's not really a significant improvement over the Bowen-York conformally flat approach for doing initial data. So, pardon? Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. You can certainly put quantitative numbers on these things, but what you said is perfectly correct. Yeah. So I don't think I really need to add anything to that. Let's see. So the question is, how do we want to do better than these sort of traditional approaches? And the way you start to do better is to try and find some physical process which is going to motivate your choices for the freely specifiable parts of the data. And the approach which has been developed in the last several years is based on this idea of quasi-equilibrium. And that is, for sufficiently separated binaries, the time scale for the orbital decay is much larger than the orbital period. That is, that during one orbital period of your binary, you're not going to change the radius of the orbit very much at all due to emission of radiation. So in essence, if you could imagine systems being in nearly circular orbits. And in particular, if you think about binaries that are in quasi-circular orbits, then this allows you to think of, or allows you the notion of an approximate helical Killing field. So you can imagine going into a rotating coordinate system where you're rotating with the binaries, and in that rotating coordinate system, basically nothing is happening to the system. It's in near equilibrium in that coordinate system. So that's what we mean by this helical Killing vector. It's this helical Killing vector which is propagating in time and also rotating. So in that picture, you know, we can use this Killing vector to help us choose these freely specifiable pieces of the problem. And so this approach was first used in the context of neutron stars. So a lot of work has been done over the last several years in this for neutron star binaries. And I'll come back in a minute with a few more details about this. But again, various numerical methods have been looked at, and I've got lots of references in here to the work that's been done in these different areas, and I'm going to forget somebody's name if I try and do it, but you can click on these links and find all of the references you want for all of this. So we have numerous numerical methods which have been tried for constructing these binary neutron stars. The physical situations which have been focused on were first co-rotating binaries, that is, they were tidally locked. That was the simplest thing to calculate initially. But of course, people realized that the low viscosity of neutron stars means that co-rotation is not a likely configuration to find a binary system in. It's much more likely that we're going to find them in what are nearly irrotational states. So methods for constructing irrotational binaries were developed. And these are the initial data schemes which are used currently both for co-rotating and irrotational binary systems for these neutron star evolutions that you've seen. And more recently, some methods have been developed, a couple of methods have been developed to actually try and move beyond the conformal flatness assumption with binary neutron stars, but that's sort of preliminary work and I don't know enough about it to say really any more than that. But there is a little bit of work beginning now to move beyond the conformal flatness assumption for binaries, for binary neutron stars. For binary black holes, using this idea of quasi-equilibrium, published work on this dates back a couple of years for binary systems, and it's work due to the Mudan group. And it uses an approach based on this sort of Misner topology, where you have this inversion symmetric data. And they use this, the Misner topology, in order to fix boundary conditions for the constrained data. This is one thing that you have to do when you have black holes that you don't have to do when you have neutron stars, is you have to fix boundary conditions where the black holes are. And so this is a real concern. And it turns out that the approach that the Mudan group used to fix these boundary conditions has problems. It leads to overdetermined boundary conditions, and you don't really find true solutions of the constraint equations. And it's purely a factor of the boundary conditions that they used here. And their boundary conditions, their choice of boundary conditions are not necessary. And I'm going to come back and say more about this in a minute. But there's another way to proceed, and that's to use, again, quasi-equilibrium to choose not only the freely specifiable data, but also to choose your boundary conditions. So this idea of quasi-equilibrium can be used to fix the problems that were in the Mudan group's approach for constructing black hole binary initial data. Okay. So let's start looking a little bit more detail at this approach for doing both neutron star and black hole initial data. And the idea goes as follows. Well, we're going to try and use quasi-equilibrium to drive our choices for things. And that's an idea which is basically, it's a dynamical notion, you know, a notion where there's no dynamics. But you want to think about a, it will help us if we think about a decomposition of the constraints, which sort of allows us to connect the dynamics. And the conformal thin sandwich decomposition is the decomposition which lets us do that. What do I want to say about this? Well, first of all, you can see the connection to dynamics here because, one, we have the lapse and the shift taking part in the decomposition. That's not what you usually find in a normal or traditional initial data decomposition. The initial data itself, usually you think of it as being completely independent of the lapse and the shift. It only involves quantities on a single initial data hypersurface. But the conformal thin sandwich approach thinks about two adjacent hypersurfaces, and they're connected by the lapse and the shift, and this gives us our connection to dynamics. All right, so let's remind ourselves that what we have here is constrained variables, which are now the conformal factor, and the shift vector is a constrained variable. It's replacing that vector v in the generalized decomposition. So we have the shift vector in here as being a constrained variable. And we have freely specifiable data here, the conformal 3 geometry and its time derivative, the trace of the extrinsic curvature and its time derivative. And now what we're going to do is we're going to think of this time vector as being this helical killing field. Okay, so we're going to have this notion of an approximate killing vector. And then in terms of this time direction, quasi-equilibrium tells us that how to choose two of these freely specifiable pieces of data. The time rate of change of the conformal 3 geometry we want to have vanish. And the time rate of change of the extrinsic curvature, or trace of the extrinsic curvature, we want that to vanish as well. These are natural choices based on quasi-equilibrium. And we're allowed to make that choice with physical this physically motivated choice because of our choice of the decomposition of the data and choosing this conformal thin sandwich approach. Okay, so let me see if I've forgotten anything I need to say for the next slide, and I don't think so. Well, okay. One thing to note is the form of the trace-free conformal extrinsic curvature here. It involves the lapse and the shift. U we're going to take to be 0 here, but you'll notice that we have this lapse in the denominator. So one thing we want to make sure we do is not let the lapse go to 0, because that's going to cause us problems. Okay, so, and in fact, that's the problem which hit the approach of the Mudong group. Okay, so this is the decomposition we're going to use, and so, okay, we need to proceed here. And so if we take the conformal thin sandwich equations and these choices, I like to call these the equations of quasi-equilibrium. And if we make now the choices of conformal flatness and maximal slicing, then this is the approach which has been used to generate binary neutron stars initial data. And along with these choices are also the boundary conditions at infinity. And the one of interest here is that the shift, because we want to have this helical killing field, we need to have a shift at infinity, which is omega cross r, essentially. We have an omega cross r-like shift at infinity. And so we have a new parameter in here, omega. The orbital angular velocity of the binary system is seen at infinity. And we have to have some way of fixing that. And in the case of neutron stars, it turns out that the matter equations come to the rescue. And in demanding that the matter also be in equilibrium, you find directly a way of fixing the correct value of the orbital angular velocity. Well, if you think about doing black hole initial data with the same scheme, the approach done by the Mudong group, for example, you don't have matter anymore. So you've got to come up with another way of choosing the orbital angular velocity. And one of their major contributions in their paper on this was to find a way of doing this by looking at the equality of the COMAR mass and the ADM mass as the approach for choosing the correct value of the orbital angular velocity. And I don't really have much time to go into that any further. The other major thing that happens when you go to black holes as opposed to neutron stars is you now need to excise a region of your domain, and that means you need boundary conditions for the constrained data. So you need boundary conditions on the conformal factor, the shift, and the lapse. And it was the Mudong group's approach to fix, or the Mudong group's approach for fixing the boundary conditions on these was to use inversion symmetry. Unfortunately, that alone wasn't enough to construct regular data, because the boundary conditions on the lapse are that it vanish at your boundary. And so they also needed to enforce a way to make the numerator, you know, this conformal killing operator acting on the shift, it had to vanish as well. And so they had to overdetermine the boundary conditions on the shift. And this overdetermination led to irregularities, and the solutions are not really solutions of the constraints, especially right near the boundaries. There's deviation there. But there are ways to get around this, as I mentioned earlier, by going back to the idea of quasi-equilibrium. And the approach quickly here is the following. If you're going to cut out a region of your manifold and impose boundary conditions on it, what you want to do is demand that that inner boundary, first of all, have vanishing outward expansion for its outward going null rays. What you're saying there is you're going to demand that that boundary that you've constructed in your domain be an apparent horizon, or at least a marginally outer trapped surface. And you're also going to demand that the time rate of change of the expansion vanish. Basically, what you're saying here is that your inner boundary is going to remain an apparent horizon as it evolves off of the initial data surface. And finally, what you're going to do is demand that the shear of the outgoing null rays on that surface vanish. These two conditions are conditions of quasi-equilibrium, and this is a condition of fixing a particular surface to be an apparent horizon. So these are the conditions that you need to generate boundary conditions, and if you work things out, the terms in red here are going to vanish because of our choices, so you wind up with, you know, three equations here for these quantities. You can see that this vanishes, so basically this term right here is going to have to vanish, and this is going to generate a boundary condition for us. The time rate of change of the expansion gives us another equation where most all the terms drop out except for this elliptic operator acting on the two-dimensional surface, acting on the difference between the perpendicular component of the shift at the surface and the lapse. And the general solution of this is just that the perpendicular component of the shift be equal to the lapse on the inner boundary. And if we demand that the shear vanish on the inner boundary, well, our solution up here is going to guarantee that one major term in this vanishes. These other terms over here vanish because we've chosen the time rate of change of the conformal 3 geometry to vanish. And what's left, it turns out, is the conformal killing operator acting on the parallel components of the shift, and that must vanish. And so altogether, this gives us boundary conditions on the conformal factor and the shift. So we get this sort of nonlinear Roban-type boundary condition on the conformal factor, and we get a form for the shift. It's going to be proportional to the lapse in the perpendicular direction. S is the unit normal to our boundary. And then the parallel components of the shift are basically free to be specified up to the fact that they must be conformal killing vectors of the two-dimensional surface. And this is the freedom right here to allow you to specify the spin of a black hole. So putting all this together, you can sort of summarize the approach. Okay, we have our decomposition of the constraints, or of the initial data variables, which are motivated by this choice from quasi-equilibrium, that the time rate of change of the conformal 3 geometry vanish. Our equations that we're going to solve, one of them is motivated directly by quasi-equilibrium. The boundary conditions on the inner boundary are motivated by quasi-equilibrium again. We can find ways of generating both co-rotational black holes and irrotational black holes. This vector here is just going to be a conformal killing vector on our surface. What's interesting is the choice of the lapse turns out to be unspecified by quasi-equilibrium. There are initial thoughts on how this might be specified by quasi-equilibrium, but it's not. And if time allows and somebody asks a question, I can answer why that is later. But what I want to end with is I want to show you some new results. So these are results based on these quasi-equilibrium boundary conditions and exploring a lot of different things. We're going to look at both co-rotational binary black holes and irrotational black holes. We're going to look at different slicing conditions, maximal slicing, and also Eddington-Finkelstein slicing. And for all of these cases, we're going to consider a set of three different boundary conditions for the laps, because we want to see if quasi-equilibrium doesn't fix what the laps should be at the boundary, then how sensitive is it to our choice? And hopefully it's not sensitive to it at all. And we'll be comparing this to some of the effective one-body work, post-Newtonian work, and also the results from the Mudong group for co-rotation and the conformal imaging and puncture early quasi-circular orbits for the irrotational cases. And so here are some results here. Given the lack of time, I think what I'll do is skip this and go to sort of the conclusion plot. But I'll just say a brief bit about here. You can see from large separation, we come in. We're looking at the binding energy versus total orbital or total angular momentum at infinity. And we have the co-rotating cases here, and we have the irrotational cases over here. And these particular cases right here are maximal slices. These up here are the Eddington-Finkelstein slices. Down here, basically coincident again, are the maximal slices with irrotation and Eddington-Finkelstein slices. So let me fast forward here to sort of the concluding slides. So this is a plot which a lot of people have looked at, where we're looking at the innermost stable circular orbit as determined by these different approaches for constructing initial data, or and also comparing it to the post-Newtonian results. So we have, again, binding energy, in this case versus orbital angular velocity. And this is all normalized with respect to the total irreducible mass of the system at the innermost stable circular orbit. And what we have on here are, first of all, the early results for Born and York type extrinsic curvature, or Born and York type initial data for both the conformal imaging and puncture data. So this is the location of the ISCO from those works. Up here we have the results from the Mudong group, the helical killing vector approach that they call it, right here. These gray open circles right here are first, second, and third post-Newtonian results from the effective one-body approach. And so we have the first, second, and third post-Newtonian for co-rotating objects, and the same thing for irrotational objects. And now if we look at the new approach using these quasi-equilibrium boundary conditions, we find that the solid circular dots right here are the three different boundary conditions for maximal slicing and co-rotation. And so we're getting three results lining up very nicely right here, sort of right in line with the post-Newtonian results. And down here are the three results for three different boundary conditions for irrotational binary black holes. Again, nicely in line with the post-Newtonian results. And if we go to the Eddington-Finkelstein type slices, things aren't quite as clean. We have three results right here. Two of them line up fairly nicely. One doesn't. Here are the irrotational results. So you can see the same general trend as you see in the first, second, third post-Newtonian results for here and here. But it's not quite as clean when we look at this additional slicing. But I think that the Eddington-Finkelstein slicing is a little, because of its construction, I think we need to be a little more careful in the choices of the laps that we use. That has to be looked at a little bit more. But it's very, it gives us a lot of confidence that when we look at maximal slicing, that we're getting fairly good independence of the results from the choice of the inner boundary. And so let me give my final slide here. So what do we need to do next? Well, the major unsolved issue that needs to be looked at is how do we choose the conformal 3 geometry? Right now, almost everything is being done with conformally flat 3 geometries. So we need ways of doing this, and people have started to look at using post-Newtonian metrics to improve the choice. And there are also ideas for doing perturbative evolutions to iteratively improve the choice of the conformal 3 geometries. And there are a few other ideas out there as well. for doing this. But this is the major improvement that needs to be done to the data, because right now this idea of quasi-equilibrium has not been used to in choosing the conformal 3 geometry. It's still being chosen for convenience. And there are a couple of other major issues that need to be thought about. First of all, how do we start taking into account the non-vanishing radial motion of the binaries when they're very close? You know, basically, when you reach the innermost stable circuit orbit, you've reached the point where you know for certain that your approximation is broken down. At that point, there has to be a significant radial motion to your binary. So if we want to be able to start initial data sets closer together, we're going to have to somehow model that non-radial motion. Otherwise, we're going to have to do at least 6 or 8 orbits before the coalescence in order to have the initial data be relatively realistic. And also, what do we want to do if we want to consider binaries in elliptical orbits? Okay, so we lose this notion of having quasi-circular orbits. So what do we do in that case? So these are open issues that need to be thought about. And there are certainly probably other things out there that need to be considered. Thank you.
Yes.
If you choose time reflection symmetric initial data, then for black holes, you know they also contain white holes in them. So if I just break the time reflection symmetry a little bit, I don't expect that to change. My question is, do you regard the existence of white holes in the data as something unphysical, and do you check for whether they're there?
Well, yes, I would consider that the existence of a white hole would be unphysical, because I assume that the black holes are going to be formed from astrophysical processes, so they're not going to be eternal black holes.
Well, but does that make them unphysical? For instance, Schwarzschild, as a vacuum solution, has a white hole in it.
Yeah, but it's an eternal.
Fill it in with, but then you know it's going to get filled in the past, so the white hole becomes physically irrelevant. So the question here is, do you want these white holes in your data? And imagine that they're really getting filled in the past, and you're just using vacuum data.
I don't really worry about that, to tell you the truth. It's not an issue that's, I think, important for the astrophysical applications.
Well, one of the problems with time reflection symmetric data, of course, is that you're putting in as much radiation as you're getting out.
Right.
And that has to do partially with the fact that, and that's connected, or brings in the fact that white holes emit gravitational radiation, in a much more easy way than black holes do, because white holes blue shift and black holes redshift.
Yeah. But I'm not doing time symmetric data.
But you're not doing. I understand that. But these factors are there if you have white holes in your data.
But we don't have time symmetric data, so we could.
I'm asking, you still might have white holes in your data, though. If I just break time symmetry by a little bit, they're not going to disappear, so you have to break it by enough to get rid of them.
The time symmetric, that's all you're saying. I mean, Einstein's equation is time symmetric.
Right.
You make an assumption about what the future is and what the past is, and so you make them black holes. Just make them black.
Well, that's my question. Is it are they
well,
turn them into white holes?
I think you would have to evolve them into the past to find out.
Well, no, you just have to look at, instead of looking for marginally trapped surfaces, which you do, you look for marginally anti-trapped surfaces. I mean, it's just an easy thing to look for.
You mentioned that your equation for the shift vector on your inner horizon gave you the freedom to specify the black hole spin.
That's right.
So I was wondering, is it known that the space of solutions, that equation is dimension 3? That's all understood? Or
the space of solutions is dimension 3?
Uh-huh.
Okay, I'm not sure. The solutions of what equation are dimension 3?
So you had an equation for the parallel component of the shift vector on the inner horizon.
Right.
You had some differential equation for it.
Right.
And then you said there was some freedom, and that allowed you to incorporate the spin of the black hole. So so is that an equation whose solution space is three-dimensional? Or is it
normal? Well, I'm trying to... Well, they're... Yeah.
And that's true even if the metric is not round?
It's conformally spherical.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay, all right.
All right, so that you have all the conformal Killing vectors you want.
Just had a comment and a question. In the graph that you showed with all the positions of the ISCOs, I was surprised. Well, it seems something similar before, but it's very interesting to notice that you almost have the frequency,
right,
which coincides very well from what we find empirically with the evolutions of the other data sets, that the frequency is of 5 factor about 2. So that's very nice. But the question is, I don't see the distance. I see binding energy versus frequency, but do you have a similar graph where you have distances of black holes? Because what's the?
I don't have that exact plot, but here is a plot of the binding energy versus proper separation. And so the ISCO is going to be at the minima here. And so all the minima here are falling roughly around an L over M of 4 to 6.
4 to 6.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So all in about the right place.
I talked a lot with the people in the Dome group who were working with them, and they told me that they agreed with your critique of their analysis of their data sets, but they regarded it as a fairly minor problem. And I just wanted to comment about that, because the results seem to more or less confirm their results in the sense that they have a little problem and a few more or less fixed it.
Yeah. Their results, I think the physics in the results was obviously a drastic improvement of what existed before. But you can see that their results sort of falls in between the results for co-rotation and irrotation. So you fix the problems, everything gets better. Yeah.
Question. All of those points were computed with this Comer mass equal to ADN mass.
That's right.
So can one also say that if you were to use the effective potential method, then probably you will not get the right answer?
That's something that we want to look at, is to actually try that. My speculation is that the effective potential method and the Comer method are basically going to give nearly the same results. But that's something we have to...
You check the Comer mass
In mind. That's something that's being looked at.
I mean, it seems to ad hoc to me, just accept them equal. I mean, I don't know what the hell that means.
Well, I mean, just the sort of picture I have in my mind is the Comer mass is only a reasonable definition of the mass when you have a stationary configuration.
That's right.
Right?
It depends on the lapse and shift.
That's right. So by making it... Right. So that's the idea.
Yeah. I mean, I would say he was...
Helical. Okay. Helical. Okay.
The way they did it was helical. But the way you put it.
Okay.
One more question then from me.
Okay.
The boundary conditions are identical to those that ABBA uses to define isolated horizon.
That's right. That's exactly right. You know, zero shear and zero expansion, zero time rate of change of the expansion.
So you're finding the boundary at the margins of surface, so you've got, say, measure space time and doesn't have to be tied to the horizon. That would be problematic for the evolution of what you do at tissue and what you go somewhere here. Like, for this, you have to tap the platform somewhere.
Let me see if I understand your question. You're wondering what do you do if you need to have data which goes a little bit inside this boundary? I thought about how to do that, and it's not a trivial problem, but basically you can't just extrapolate data in because that's an unstable thing to do. So what you really need to do is specify some kind of boundary conditions inside of your apparent horizon. And basically, I think the best you can do is use some sort of minimization technique or root finding technique to sort of choose Dirichlet data on that inner boundary in such a way that you satisfy the boundary conditions you want on your apparent horizon. So you can imagine for each boundary point on your grid that's on the apparent horizon, you have one boundary point corresponding to it inside, some distance inside. And so then you have a space of points that you can vary the data on to try and enforce a condition, the boundary condition you were applying on what was your inner boundary,
on what is now just a point in the interior of your domain. So you vary those boundary points in a root finding or minimization technique to try and maintain the boundary conditions you want.
Wouldn't you just kind of linearize the whole thing now instead of setting a theta equals 0 of theta equals minus 1 to 1? I mean, it's being a constant, it's being a surface,
you, and
you're probably going to be a
cooler. You can do that, but now what should the shear be inside? I don't know.
So, can you use non mass holes?
Yes. In principle, we can do that. Harold has been working on that. By the way, I think I neglected to mention that the numerics here were done with Harold Pfeiffer's elliptic solving codes. And Harold's been working on the non-equal mass case, but he's finding some unusual things in that limit when you try and go to the point mass limit. And we need to look at that a little bit more to try and understand what's going on. But in principle, there's no limit to the mass ratios. You can also, you're also not limited to co-rotational or irrotational black holes. You can put arbitrary angular velocity on these holes. Yes?
Thinking of these sequences of data that you, and if you go back away from the ISCO, you have less binding energy and a lower omega. If you're going toward these other cases, I'm wondering how, you have an idea of how close those non-ISCO, circular but non-ISCO configurations you have, in some sense, at least on this plot, would compare with the ISCO being somewhat similar but a different ISCO?
I haven't had a chance to sort of, you know, plot out the post-Newtonian sequences. So for what the post-Newtonian results are for binding energy versus orbital angular velocity and the other variables as a function of separation and compare those with my results. Basically, I think your point is that am I choosing the ISCO correctly, and if I'm too far in, if I go a little bit further apart, am I getting better results?
I'm thinking of the two-by finding here in the platform.
Yeah.
And then the sequence of pre-ISCO versus post-ISCO, and then comparing those data.
Oh, for these down here?
Yeah.
Well, certainly when you look at these, as you go to larger and larger separation, you're agreeing better and better with the post-Newtonian results. So again, you know, a lot of this is, or at least some of the discrepancy you see here may be in the choice of where you put the ISCO and your condition for doing it. And that's a very, that's one of the major problems in comparing data sets is what are you going to compare? And this is basically the only thing we have to compare, you know, as for single data points, and it's the worst thing we could think of, you could want to compare. Yeah. So I'm certain that as you go to larger and larger separation, everything agrees better. The question is, where do you cut things off?
Right.
Your solutions are the constraints.
Yeah. With a certain set of approximations. Yeah. But the thing to remember is, when you hit the ISCO here, you are guaranteed that at that point your approximations have broken down.
Yeah.
So, you know, with this sort of initial data, you know from sort of the work that I've seen from Mark Miller that you have to go at least 6 or 7 orbits out beyond what you think of as the ISCO to be guaranteed that the radial infall rate is small enough to really consider this to be true circular orbits. Yeah.
Any other questions? All right, let's thank Greg.